move to Litra 3 out of 5, 2 more to go, hanging there. And so what I will show you right now is I will go into slightly more details of actually things I already said, which is like the dark matter clustering and galaxy survey and their relations, right? How you can and I will be it's again just it's pretty quick just key concept, and I'll let you go through the equation by yourself if you're interested. I just wanted to cover the key ideas, right? So it's a bit qualitative. And so we'll start by trying to understand the broad feature of the galaxy power spectra, or the dark matter power spectra, then understand its shape. Then I will introduce sigma 8 that you probably need to know what it is. I will talk about bias, and then I will cover the history of galaxy surveys and how we measure galaxy at various times. And then I'll show you the more recent measurement and then future measurement for galaxy. So what is PK, right? So basically the first simple thing to do is that you have dark matter distribution. On PK here will be for this lecture, PK will refer to the dark matter power spectra. So what you do, you have a dark matter, you consider it as a continuous field. Dark matter, you look at it as a three-dimensional field. You take the Fourier transform, you go to Fourier space, and then you average the norm of each of your Fourier mode in shells of constant wave mode, right? So you so for a given point in your Fourier parameter space, the norm of this wave mode is the square root of the norm of square root of kx1, ky square, kz square. And so this will give you a given wave number. And so measuring the power spectra will be just averaging the norm of the Fourier modes inside this shell, a shell of a given wave number, okay? And so if you look at the power spectra, the predicted power spectra for dark matter has this specific shapes here. It grows here, being dumped here, and you see this kind of slow oscillation here, which is just what we talked about before, right, which are bionic wiggles. So the question is, why should we study PK? So basically, PK is interesting because you can probe. PK will be sensitive to the. And one big thing here that we left in this lecture, and I guess the one before, is that we're moving into understanding the inhomogeneous universe, right? Before, we're interested in homogeneous universe, measuring distances, and so neglecting perturbations. We are using perturbation as a ruler, right? So bionic oscillation, the BAO are just, of course, results from inhomogeneities, but we were just interested in the size as a ruler. Now we go into the physics of inhomogeneities and try to understand. Try to understand the qualitative feature. Okay, so why are we interested in PK? So why are we interested in measuring the inhomogeneities of dark matter? It's basically because you can also learn more about the cosmological parameters. And first of all, you can learn easily about the matter power spectrum, the baryon abundance again, or the dark energy content. And also, if you do a galaxy survey, that's the first thing you measure, right? So you just look at galaxy, you measure their power spectrum. This is the most natural thing you can do. Let's say you measure the power spectrum, from that you try to infer the constraint on omega matter, baryon, and dark energy. And understanding PK will be the dark matter power spectra will be the key quantity that you will use later on to predict other probes of the inhomogeneities of the universe, for example, the CMB or the cosmic shear or Lyman and Mapforest, which I won't detail. But so understanding the PK and the qualitative aspect of the PK will be key to predict other observations. Okay, and so if we look at the shape of the power spectra, basically you have this qualitative feature. So here you have this wave number, right? So it's large scale, small scales. What you see is that at small scale, the power spectra increase with k and is actually linear in k, so pk is proportional to k. Then you see that you have a peak whose actually position will depend on omega matter, okay? And then you have suppression of the matter power spectra, and this goes down actually fold quicker than it rises. So the power spectra goes like k to the minus 3, and you also have, you know, wiggles here, which are baryonic effects we talked about before, okay? And so I will ask you to understand this power spectra, we will assume that we have some processes in the early universe, and as I think you will hear much more about it like in coming lectures tomorrow and the day after. Let's say we have inflation, and inflation set a set of initial conditions, so a set of initial inhomogeneities. And the way you will characterize this inhomogeneities is basically by looking at their power spectra, okay, and their statistics. And because inflation will directly produce Gaussian fluctuations, all the statistical information of this field will be in the power spectra, okay? So you only need to know the power spectra, and we'll assume that this power spectra is basically scale invariant, so it goes like k, okay? And we also use adiabatic modes only, which means like initially all the fluids you consider dark matter, baryons, photons have the same over density, okay? And we'll neglect iso curvature components. And you could consider all kinds of perturbations to the metric. So you can have scalar mode, tensor mode, and vector mode in principle. In practice, scalar modes are the ones which are really dominant, and we'll only consider them. So if you are in linear theory, if you work in linear theory, it basically, as we did for the CMB and as we did for the BAO, it means that for linear theory to work, you need all the perturbations to be small. And it's not, you know, it's not absurd to consider that perturbation small, because if you look at the CMB, you know, it's just really, really small. And the fact that, as you know, what's happening in the universe is that you start with very tiny fluctuations which grow by linear instability and will form the large scale structure as we see today, okay? So you start from tiny perturbation, they grow up, and you end up with the nonlinear structures we see today, so galaxy or clusters of galaxy, or, you know, cosmic waves, etc. Okay, and so if you start from linear theory, you can solve everything numerically, and there are actually public codes to do that, for example, CMBFAST or CAM, which allows you to solve the evolution through times of dark matter or dark energy, of dark matter or baryons, and this is expected to work very well at early times on large scales, as we saw before. Okay, and so because why large scale? Because basically, the way things work in the universe is that basically nonlinearities will form at small scale first. So you'll have small objects that will collapse. Nonlinearities will form at small scale, and then as these objects grow more and more, the nonlinearities expand to larger and larger scales. So nonlinearities go from small scale to large scales, and so as you go to lower and lower redshift, your nonlinear scales goes from high k to low k. Okay, and so for example, today typically the nonlinear scale, so the scale at which you can neglect nonlinear effects, will be in h per megaparsec, it will be 0. At z of 0, it will be 0.1 typically. Okay, so it's no, sorry, 0.001. So it's, which is, you know, qualitatively the same scale as the baryonic oscillation we saw before. Okay, so just to give you another magnitude. So, sorry.
Is the derivative small?
What do you mean?
I mean, if you have some second derivative, you can even more generally. That's kind of what the question is now.
Well, if you go in non-linear regime, you mean for the linear, that's right, they are both small, velocities are, yeah, also, that's, well,
like a row prime, if it's more primitive.
No, equals. It's equals, sorry, typo, yeah. Here it's actually equal, yeah. No, no, but the linear, I mean, perturbation, what matters really here, you will do linear theory, you expand in terms of delta, right, over density. So delta is much, much smaller than one at initial times. Yeah, sorry, just a typo. Just a translation. Okay, so what are the key ingredients to understand the shape of the power spectra? So what we need to do is that we need to know the expansion rate of the universe either in radiation dominated times or matter dominated times. And as we saw yesterday, when you're in a radiation dominated universe, A goes like T to the half, whereas your matter dominated universe, A goes like T to the 2/3, okay? And another thing we'll need to know is a Jeans lens, and I will define what it is. And you need to know the Jeans lens either in a matter-dominated universe or in a radiation-dominated universe. And you also need to know the growth rate of fluctuation in either in radiation times or matter-dominated time. And those are like the three pieces we need to put together in order to explain qualitatively the shape of the power spectrum. Okay, so we saw this yesterday, so now I'm moving to the Jeans lens. So what is a Jeans lens? Basically, the Jeans lens is that, there is no gravity, any perturbations in gravity is unstable. So if you have a totally homogeneous distribution, things are static. If you have little perturbations, it will attract matter and matter, so the perturbation will grow bigger and bigger. Okay, so that's structure will grow through this process. On the typical time scale for this, for gravity, you can write it as g times rho, okay, to the half. Okay, so it's just, that's a characteristic time scale for the growth of a perturbations of this density, okay? Now, if you have a fluid, at some point, pressure will resist the total collapse of this object, okay? And the typical time scale for pressure to act over distance, over this kind of distance, over distance lambda, is set by the sound speed CS, okay? And so the typical time scale for distance lambda G is like the following. And so basically, the Jeans scale is what we call the Jeans scale is basically the scale at which pressure is able to contract the collapse of gravity, okay? And so basically it's a scale at which both of the characteristic times, sorry, is equal. Okay, and so basically the Jeans scales, you can express it as CS over G rho, square root over G rho, okay? So it tells you it's basically the scale at which pressure is big enough to stop the collapse due to gravity, okay? That's a Jeans lens. So what does it mean again? It means that if you have a wavelength, if you consider modes which are larger than the wavelength, they just collapse and grow under gravity, okay? And on the other hand, if you consider fluctuations which are smaller than the Jeans wave scale, then they will basically oscillate between they will be pushed back by pressure and then collapse again, push back and collapse again. So they will oscillate and you will have pressure waves and you will have oscillation between collapsing and expanding. Okay. So that's the physical meaning of this Jeans lens. Now in a radiation dominated universe, the clamping of radiation will dominate the gravity, and the squashing of radiation will resist further clamping. So at some scale, you won't be able to collapse more than this squashing scale. On the other hand, in a matter-dominated universe, the radiation is negligible, and the clamping, this time the gravity will come from the clamping of dark matter only. Okay, but there is nothing basically. For all purposes, at least for large-scale structure, dark matter is pressureless. Okay, so there's basically nothing that prevents that will prevent the total collapse of dark matter. Okay, so you'll have to, so the gene scale basically means that the gene scale is very, very small, okay, for in the matter dominated region. So, as we saw, before, in a radiation dominated era, the gene length is proportional to the inverse of square root of rho, okay? And we know that rho goes like a to the minus 4, so that the gene scales go like a square, okay? On the other hand, in the matter-dominated era, the gene scale, basically, you can, for all purposes, it should be just 0, okay? So if you look, now if you look at the evolution of the, you can phrase the gene scale is also a gene scale, you can transfer, for a given density field, you can convert a length scale into a mass, right? There is a one-to-one correspondence. And so if you look at the mass to if you look at the mass, gene's mass, which is what used to be considered earlier, like when people started to study gravitational collapse, if you look at the evolution, and this, what you have here is this log of the scale factor. So here is radiation dominated, and here is present, so of A of 1. What you see that initially the gene's mass increases, so more and more it takes bigger and bigger objects to resist the gravitational collapse. But at some point, when you go from the radiation era to the matter era, suddenly this gene's length will collapse and will go to zero or almost zero, which is what you see here, right? So basically, you will have, and this is a recombination, which is just soon after radiation matter equality, okay? And so that's evolution of gene scale as a function of time or expansion of scale factor. And so now we know the expansion rate, we know the gene length for various radiation dominated in the radiation dominated era or matter dominated era, and now we need to know the missing point here is the gross rate of fluctuation in these two periods, and so again in the radiation dominated era the gene scales will grow as a square, and for any wavelength which is smaller than lambda g, you will have no growth, so you will just oscillate. So this wavelength won't grow. On the other hand, in the matter-dominated era, the growth will go like is proportional to a, not a square. So it means that the perturbations which are greater, whose wavelength is greater than the gene's length, will grow like a or one over one plus z. Okay, and so. So now, if you imagine you have a very, very large scale mode, lambda, okay, which is basically, it's always bigger than the gene's length, okay? So it will grow as a square in a radiation-dominated era, and then it will grow at a in a matter-dominated era. So on this, the growth is basically totally, is all scale independent, so all modes will grow at the same speed, and so basically you don't disturb anything, and so what you should see on the large scale, we should see basically a scaled version of the initial perturbation power spectra. Okay, and so if your initial spectra is scale invariant as it is for inflation, then on large scale you will again expect to see a scale invariant power spectra. Okay, on the other hand, if you consider scales, smaller scales, so in the sense that it's a scale for which that will at some point become, so let's say you consider a small scale, so the gene's length grow as a to the a square, right? And if you consider a scale small enough, at some point the gene's length will become bigger than the scale you consider, so that at some point the growth of structure will stop, okay? And so And so basically, there is a scale range for which the growth of structure will stop for a while during the radiation dominated era. Okay, after matter radiation, then all the modes will start to grow again. Okay, and so basically, what sets a feature of this the turnover scale that you see in the matter power spectra is basically the Jeans lens. What sets this bump is basically the Jeans lens at the time of matter radiation equality. Okay, and so as I said, just like the scale which are greater than this scale will always grow, whereas scale which are smaller than this scale will have experienced some period where they are stalled and they stop growing, and so that's why you see this decrease in power. Okay. Now you can wonder how does omega matter affect the position of this peak? Okay, and basically by just measuring the position of this turnover scale, you in principle you can infer omega matter fairly accurately. Okay, and so if the more matter you have, the earlier in time will be the matter radiation equality. Okay, so it means that there's less time for there are less modes. There's less time for modes to stagnate or stop growing. Okay, so basically it means that you expect as you increase dark matter to have you expect the turnover scale to move to the right so that you have less mode which stagnates. Okay, and so if you compute things properly, that's what you have here. And what you have here is you have two matter power spectrum as I just showed before, the function of wave mode, and here is for omega matter 0.3. The solid line on the dashed line is for omega matter 0.4. And you see that when you increase omega matter, again, when you increase omega matter, you push back in time the time of matter radiation equality, and so it moves, it moves to a smaller scale. Okay, so it's earlier in time, so the apparent scale will be smaller. Okay, and so you see a shift in your power spectra to the right. Okay, does it make sense? Anyone or kind of? Okay, so that's a key. Let's say that's one way to understand the qualitative feature of this power spectra. Okay, then we have bionic oscillations. I won't come back to that, but again, you know, CMB, and you have these wiggles here, but that's all measurement. And so now another parameter which is of interest is the sigma 8, right? So basically, so far we talked about the shape of this power spectra, but we didn't talk at all about the amplitude, and the amplitude is actually also interesting observationally. And so usually the quantity which is used to quantify it is a sigma 8, right? It's a Hermes of basically the variance of like sigma 8 square will be the variance of mass fluctuation in sphere of radius 8 megaparsec. Okay, so if you have a matter power spectra, okay, sigma r square will become this is an integral with a given window over pk, and so which gives you the amplitude of the. So if you are looking at your density field, you smooth it, you have a smoothing kernel of width 8 megaparsec, and you measure the amplitude, the variance of this field, that will give you sigma 8. Okay, and so the expression to compute sigma 8 from pk is the following, where this is a well-defined window, it's a simple analytics, and so basically sigma 8 is the amplitude of pk at k of 1/8 megaparsec roughly. And so there are two ways to define them, to quantify the amplitude. People use either, depending on your point of view. So either if you look at the low redshift universe, you tend to sigma 8 is an observable quantity because you are probing scales which are much larger and much smaller than a megaparsec, so you have access to sigma 8. On the other hand, if you come from the early universe side, what matters to you is only the normalization of the initial power spectra, which is, you know, the one that choose to be slightly scale invariant. So what matters would be an amplitude A in front of your scale invariant power spectra, or nearly scale invariant. So there is, if everything was linear, there would be a one-to-one correspondence between sigma 8 and A in practice, because of nonlinear effects, which are not totally negligible at 8 megaparsec. There's the correspondence between sigma 8 and A is not exactly one-to-one, but it's roughly speaking that's what it is. So now if you look at the window functions, so if you look at this window here, W, which is a kernel that you use to measure sigma 8 from pk, it's actually this function here, okay? And you see that it's basically, it peaks at basically 1/8. But it's not, you know, going from a Fourier space to the real space is not exactly one to one. So you have that's why you have some, it's kind of a smoothing kernel. Okay. So that's the definition of sigma 8, which is it's a practical quantity. But now it seems to be more and more. If you talk about CMB, you will talk about AES. If you talk about galaxy, if you talk about cluster survey, you will talk about sigma 8, but more and more AES has become the key cosmological quantity. Now, how do we relate galaxy power spectrum and the matter power spectrum? Okay, so although I said that so far the matter power spectrum, what are the pk, which is would be key to understand all the observables we're interested in, is a dark matter power spectrum. What you observe again is galaxies, right? And galaxies are purely baryonic. Well, not purely baryonic, but they are baryonic objects. And it's not a, it's a discrete sample of your dark matter density field. So you have a dark matter density field, and you have some, just a collection of points along this, which are basically galaxies. And so, so measuring one, to inferring the dark matter distribution from galaxies is not, you need some hypothesis, and usually it's a, it will come from in the form of a bias, which I wrote earlier here. And so it's very hard to, you understand that if you want, really want to understand fully this thing, it's actually very complicated, because you really want, galaxy formation is actually, this time it's very, very, very nonlinear, and you have all kind of processes involving all, you will need to know, it's all kind of messy baryonic physics, so you need to know, you know, properties of dust, you need to know all the radiation transfer in dust, you need to know the merging history of galaxies, so galaxies don't form here and stay like that. You know, as you know, they form earlier on, and then they will merge, and then they will gather in clusters, etc. So it's extremely messy. So you, there is no way you can compute the bias, so the relation between galaxies, statistical properties, and matter on nonlinear scales, okay? But with some approximation, you can still you can still hope to do it. And basically, if you work on a scale large enough in a linear regime again, you expect to have a linear relation between galaxy and dark matter, okay? Which would be a key assumption in most of the surveys. And so, of course, if you start to look more about galaxies, the more closely you look at the surveys, the more you will learn about galaxy formation, about galaxy evolution. But your increasing knowledge won't be necessarily useful for pure, you know, cosmological constraints. But you have to keep that in mind. And so that's the way it looks typically, for example. So that's a typical picture. That's a simulation, but it really matches very well, let's say, what we observe. And what you see in the background, the gray fluctuations are, it's a dark matter field, okay? And so you see what this structure is called the cosmic web, okay? So you basically you see there are huge void under density, and then you see filaments connecting, filaments which are interconnected. And this, for example, this scale here would be typically megaparsec scale. And so this, and this is the scale corresponding to a clusters of galaxy. And basically the picture you can, the qualitative picture for the cosmic web would be a collection of galaxy clusters, objects, you know, the mass 10 to the 15 solar mass, 10 to the 14 solar mass, which are interconnected by filaments, okay, and basically matter. And all this is starting from Gaussian, it's like starting from a homogeneous Gaussian distribution. And you see that because of gravitational instability, I should have shown you a movie, I just forgot that, but because of gravitational instability, you will see that some peaks will grow denser and denser, and the denser they grow, they will attract matter, and matter will actually not fall uniformly, but will tend to organize and fall according to filaments. And so basically you have, if you look in this area here, the matters, if you look at the matter flow, it will go like that and go along this filament. And it's, there are all kinds of studies you can do about the topology of this kind of filament, etc. But the key point here is that each dot here corresponds to, it's again, it's a simulation, it's not a study, but each point here corresponds to a galaxy. And it's a model where you try, it's called a semi-analytical model, because what you do is that you run N-body simulations, which have dark matter only, which are exact. If you put dark matter only, you know to solve exactly for gravity. And so you have a full nonlinear treatment. And then you try to model all the process involved in galaxy formation, and you try to take into account the galaxy histories, a merger, etc., and you end up with galaxies which are, you know, they are tracing the underlying dark matter, but not exactly, okay? And so on each color of galaxy, each color of this dot corresponds to a different type of galaxy, okay? So let's say if you look at these galaxies, they will be either elliptical or spiral, and they will be different types of spiral, different, and each of them will have a different spectra. So if you were to observe them, you will see different things. But so the key point here is that you can still see that if you observe only what you observe is you observe only the point, right? There's a color point, and you try to infer the statistics of the underlying field. Okay, so it's, you understand that you have to be a bit careful. But the key thing is that if you look on large scales, let's say on linear scales, so again, here's a galaxy cluster, here's a galaxy cluster. So let's say the linear scale would be if you smooth your field, if you smooth this picture on scale, which are like the size of my hand, which would be like 10 megaparsec, basically, or 8 megaparsec, it should be mostly linear, okay? And you can see that if you look at a very large scale, a scale bigger than that, your galaxies will be our fair tracer of the underlying dark matter, okay? And so that and this kind of approximation of the linear bias description is well motivated. And so you can derive that analytically. You can so do that very qualitatively. But you can motivate the fact that bias has to be linear on large scales. And if you basically if you make the on the only approximations that goes into that is basically saying that the galaxy. Well, it's not it. The approximation going to that is basically that saying that the galaxy density is the galaxy formation is a local process, okay, in the sense that it only depends at the dark matter density at this point in space, okay, so it doesn't depend it's just basically local. And so if you do that, you can Taylor expand this function, and the first term will give you, that's the one you observe, will give you a linear bias. So that's really the only assumption that's underlying that. And basically, it's really the fact that galaxy is a local, galaxy formation process is a local formation process, okay? And so it means that with using this assumption, basically, you can say that the power spectrum of galaxies you observe will be proportional with factor b squared to the matter perturbation, dark matter power spectra. Universally, the sigma 8 you observe from galaxies is related to the sigma 8 you observe from the sigma 8 from dark matter. So in practice, if you want to measure sigma 8, you can ask me how do you actually measure the sigma, right? How do you actually know the sigma? And so because you see that it's a perfect degeneracy, right? If you really want to know this quantity, it's a perfect degeneracy with one. So you have to know you have to be able to separate them. So there are several ways you can use to do that. One of them is one technique is, for example, imagine you use a CMB to fix. So what's happening? You know that you have the CMB that fix that gives you a picture of the perturbation very early on in time, and you can measure the calibration very well. So you can measure the amplitude very well, and there's no bias. You just measure the absolute. You are able to measure the absolute amplitude. So you can calibrate, for example, your power spectrum using the CMB, and then you look at lower time, and then you can infer the bias from that. Okay, that's one technique. Another technique is to do. Another technique would be, for example, if you don't look so far, I'm looking only at the two-point function, so the power spectra, but you can compute more sophisticated statistics, which involve like three-point function or more, or four-point function, and then you are able to playing this game by combining two-point and three-point. You can actually you can build an estimator for B, which won't depend anymore on sigma 8. So it's a bit, I won't get into the detail, but all these kind of games, you can actually measure also sigma 8. Or, and as you heard the other day also from Neta, there are other ways to measure sigma 8. For example, if you count clusters, the if you look at this, this picture here, and you just don't try to measure the power spectra, you just count the number. Imagine you find a quantitative way to identify clusters of galaxies, right? You have one here, one here, one here, one here, etc. If you just count this object, okay, this gives you, this is directly related to sigma 8 without any bias, okay? Because basically the more qualitatively, that the higher sigma 8, the stronger will be your initial density peaks, and so the more clusters you will form at a later time. Okay, and so interestingly enough, this is qualitatively, and if you want to try to match, there's an interesting exercise which is trying to match the number of objects on large scale that you see in a low redshift universe, for example, the number of galaxy clusters to the statistics on the peak density of your initial conditions, which are, for example, you probe in a CMB. And anyway, there's another game. But basically, I'm saying that just counting this object, these clusters, gives you an other handle on sigma 8, which will allow you to measure the bias also. Okay, so there are techniques, there are tricks to still do this measurement, measuring the absolute amplitude of the matter power spectrum given the galaxy power spectrum, but you have to be careful, and it's a difficult business. And then you have to worry about the validity of your assumption. And for example, the bias will depend on redshift, and it won't be the same for the same galaxy population. The bias will evolve with time. Also, for the bias might not be the same, will be non-linearities at some point will kick in, so it means that the bias will become scale dependent. So this function here will become scale dependent, so which will be another complication, etc. So okay, so now I'm looking back a little bit at history, and just to give you an idea of where we're coming from, and it's an interesting perspective, I think. So back in the days, so Herschel was able to identify, looking at the sky, you know, just with a telescope, was able to, late 19th century, was able to identify 1,000, basically, objects. Okay, he had a catalog already, just with some telescope, and then we went back to, you know, to the early 90s, where we were able to started to automate everything, and this is all, this is before, basically, the advent of CCDs, right? This is before the advent of the cameras. So this is like photographic, these surveys are based on photographic plates, right? So you look at the sky, put a photographic plate, develop it, count the object, etc. And this, and doing so, people were able to collect about, you know, several millions of objects, right? So it was a huge effort. And And the most next version was a leak. And this is all done by eye, right? So you have really people who spend their, who really devote an incredible amount of time just to look at these pictures, try to look at objects, try to catalog them according to their type, according to their color. And you add colors by putting a filter in front of your telescope and looking at the ratio, the brightness ratio in terms of different different plates. So it's a tremendous effort. And actually, all the surveys which were, you know, the technology was totally different, but they all qualitatively got the right answer already, right? So now we do things much more quantitatively, which much more precision, but still qualitatively we have the answer, and we were able to measure the galaxy clustering accurately with the right slope, etc. So the leak survey, and this is starting to be automatic in a early 90s, and you see that the structure here, and you see better here. You see, this is the same thing I showed you in simulation, right? But basically you see the typical cosmic web when you have overdensities, and you see voids, and you see filaments connected each of these big clusters of galaxies. Okay, so it's qualitatively the same thing. Yeah, so this is typically what you do is that you don't measure, you either measure in Fourier space or real space. So if you do it in real space, you are looking at the excess sigma psi of r, which is an excess correlation of galaxy above a Poisson noise. Okay, so you look for an excess correlation as a function of scale. You look what you will. You take all your objects. You take all the objects, you take for a given distance, you take all the objects which are separated by a given size, and you average, you know, the typical, you come to the correlation function, and what you're looking at, you're looking for an excess above just pure Poissonian noise, pure shot noise, okay, and it's quantified by this sigma r. So you can wonder why we use sigma 8, and basically, sigma 8 was a convenient, why we use 8 megaparsec, and it's totally arbitrary, right? It's a historical artifact, but basically it was a scale for which size basically one. Okay, so at 8 megaparsec you are in a linear regime, but not fully, but historically it was a well observed scale, so people thought that would be it was the right scale to measure the galaxy correlation function. Now here are the first, so if you try not to measure the two-point function, but used to, this are the first measurement basically of the power spectrum using the APM, which is an automatic plate, automatic plate measurer, okay, which was the first measure of the power spectra in the 1990s. You know, the quality. This is the first measurement here, estimate of 0.7. And qualitatively, it's correct. And what you see here, you see the departure. And you see this departure is coming basically from nonlinearities, right? So this curves come from the linear power spectrum. And then if you go to scale small enough, nonlinear effects start to be bought on, and we create an excess correlation, which is what you see here, okay? This is like 19 years ago, right? So we knew already all this 19 years ago. And where are we now? It's like things become much more sophisticated, much more automated. Now, for example, you have the 2DF survey, which was able to collect several 250,000 galaxies with redshift. And it's not very deep, like a minute redshift of about 0.17. And also then you have your slow digital scale survey I mentioned before. It's like aims at a million of galaxy surveys. Final area was about like 10,000 square degree, so quarter of the sky. And you had 300,000 galaxies with precise redshift with what you could measure the spectra, and you had like a 141 million objects, you know, collected and mapped. So it's a tremendous data set, and it's still produced. People are still analyzing it, and it's still producing papers. And daily, people are using Sloan to constrain all kinds of things, right? So cosmology, but also more, let's say, more astrophysically focused focused studies. Here's a picture of the telescope. There is a picture of a spectra you can measure typically when you see the various lines, and you can identify the lines of oxygen, etc. And here's the area you observed with Sloan. This is a map of the sky in the galactic coordinate, and you see this big strip here. So it's and this is basically, this is observed. This is not a simulation. This is really what you observe with the Sloan. So the quality is not so good. And you see clearly, it's very, you know, remarkable, all this, the cosmic web. You see voids, filament, and overdensity with this cluster, or like a structure which are even bigger than a cluster. It's okay. And it's really remarkable. But and this is like up to a Z of 1. This must be like the median redshift must be 0.7 must be around here. So the on this and at the end here, like the blue objects will be quasars, which are redshift of about 2. Okay, so it's a very very beautiful thing. And from that you can actually measure, you can try to measure the and you can measure the power spectra. And this is like current measure of the power spectra as of 2004, so it's slightly better since then. And you see that the scales are not loud enough. So as compared to the previous plot, right, it's a zoom. So the scale are not loud enough to really measure the turnover scale. Okay, but you still that you are going well into the, you have the slope very well. And from that you can, you are well into the nonlinear regime actually. And from that you can actually try to constrain using the modeling, you can try to constrain parameters. And from some of you ask about how do you measure the spectral index, the initial spectral index. And for example, I told you that the initial conditions were for example, coming from inflation, were providing you generically with a spectra which go like a to the k to the n, or n is close to 1, but not exactly 1. And so it's nearly scale invariant, and actually the value of the precise value of n is important if you want to know about the, if you want to learn about the detail of the physics, what's going on at time of inflation, so exactly what, you know, what theory you should consider. And so this kind of plot, by measuring, let's say, the ratio, the amplitude of this point, the highest k point, the lowest k point, there's a strong mapping between this ratio and the spectral index, as you can guess, right? And if you change the spectral, if you increase n, the spectra becomes steeper, and if you decrease, it becomes flatter. And so using this data set, you can actually measure n's very well, and if you combine that with CMB, you can actually have good constraint on ns and then learn about inflation. Okay? And you will hear much more about that tomorrow. And now, that's a nice way to plot it. It's like, if what is a dark energy? If you try to constrain what is the allowed in your parameter space of baryon density and dark matter density, you can wonder what is the allowed space. Okay. In principle, from first principle, a priori everything is allowed, right? And if you use the constraint coming from the abundance of primordial elements, which is the BDN, so I didn't talk about that. I'm not sure anyone will talk about that, but basically you have, by looking at the abundance of primordial light elements like deuterium, lithium, etc., you can have constraint of exactly the baryonic content of the universe, and you get this kind of constraint, okay? Now, if you add CMB, you measure, you have this kind of, you can exclude all this parameter space, okay? So the red is what is ruled out by CMB. So CMB tells you that dark matter and baryons, you allow only this region, okay? And if you combine that with the Sloan, you end up with this. You end up with this constraint. So you see that it's a very complementary measurement to CMB, and basically it's really measuring, really. I explain you very qualitative features, but basically if you do that quantitatively, you can, by looking at the exact shape of the power spectrum of the exact tilt, you can actually constrain the baryon density and the matter density. And by combining both, you have, you know, you allow this parameter space. So it's a very powerful galaxy surveys, and galaxy clustering is a very powerful probe of the matter content of the universe. Okay. Now, future, what we can expect. Sloan will be finished and has been extended. Now we have Sloan 3 going on. There's a 6-degree field, deep 2, all kind of surveys. And what's really going to happen is that, for example, that's happening, for example, DES now. We expect 300 million photometric redshift. So it's slightly delayed. It's more like 2010 now. But that was the initial plan, at least. We'll have the Large Aperture Synoptic Survey Telescope, which will map half the sky up to basically have all the objects till a redshift of 1, typically round or little, and then several kinds of objects several kind of objects to higher redshift. And so there's still a lot to, and also as we told you before, we also learned, so these surveys are happening, and they were initially designed to measure galaxy clustering, but also people devised new way to use them, and for example to use BAO or something like that. So this survey were now more and more motivated, and that you'll be able to use their catalogs of objects in a very diverse manner, and you'll be able to cross check things using different techniques. Okay. And I will stop that, I think. So what went over, basically we understood the turnover, the qualitative feature of the power spectra. We understand the turnover related to the genes lens. We I defined sigma it and discussed the bias, and I'll give you a somewhat historical review of galaxy surveys. And I think I will stop here. So, thank you.
So we'll meet, the guest lecture will be 2 o'clock in the theater.